You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to the Apple Insider Podcast. This is episode 55. And with me today, again, reprise from last week, Neil Hughes, Managing Editor.
Hey, Mikey, how's it going?
Pretty good, Neil. Pretty good. Jumping right in, I see this morning that we have a couple of exclusives. One of particular interest is the Apple, quote, Apple car. Something about motor noises coming out of their facility there. What's going on? I thought it was an electric car, Neil.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of people are saying in the comments and stuff, which I never said that the motor noises were necessarily coming from an Apple car. It's just the site where we know that they're working on some sort of automotive project. There's a lot of construction going on there as well, so more likely that it's related to some of that. But I suppose it's possible that they have a prototype with an engine there or something. I don't know. I don't know what's going on there specifically, which is why we report on it and put it out there. But it's a site that Apple has taken over. They lease 7 buildings there. And there have been a number of improvements that have been done. We, through our research, have found permits approving auto work area, garage, repair garage, all kinds of automotive-related stuff there. And digging around this week, found that a resident who lives in a neighborhood adjacent to the facility actually sent in a complaint to the city code enforcement saying that there were motor noises coming from the property late at night. So just one of those kind of interesting tidbits. As I said in the story, that there's a lot of construction going on there. Apple was also approved to put up a 10-foot fence with gates around the property to keep out prying eyes and that sort of thing. So a lot of potential for noise from a lot of things there. But we do know that there's something automotive going on there to some extent, whether it's CarPlay related or Project Titan or what, who knows.
And well, I mean, we still don't know. I mean, obviously, Apple is working on perhaps some sort of electric vehicle. But do we know for a fact that it is an electric vehicle that they're working on? I think people are kind of taking they're taking that for granted right now. I mean, Apple could be working on like a subsystem or something just to start out with. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, I mean, anything's possible. I mean, even potentially, I don't think they would do a hybrid vehicle. I think that Apple would be more likely to make an all-electric vehicle, but it's possible that if they were creating the brains for other people's cars, that they might be testing it out in different ways, that sort of stuff. It's hard to say exactly what's going on there because Apple, being so secretive, obviously is not going to let us know what's going on there. But it was a year ago that Mikey, you and I worked on this story where we kind of dug into this facility where one of our sources told us is kind of the ground zero for so-called Project Titan. And did some poking around there at this facility where a company by the name of 68 Research had advertised that they were operating out of. And we started looking into this company, 68 Research, who said they were a leading market research company or something like that. And it turned out that there really wasn't much of any evidence that they did anything at all, which led to some speculation that they might actually be a front for Apple, that they could hide behind a company name, just a shell corporation, to do things without bringing any attention. And so one of the things that we found was that they imported a Fiat 1957 model under the name 68 LLC, which we assume was Apple. And then last November, it was discovered that 68 Research was an attendee at the Euro Car Body 2015 Global Car Body Benchmarking Conference, which is a mouthful of the name of a show. But so there's a lot of evidence connecting Apple to 68. We can't say for sure that they're related, but they are supposedly headquartered out of this building that Apple is leasing space in and is now building a 10-foot fence around and has motor noises emanating from. So there's a lot of smoking guns here.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, aside from the fact that Fiat is hideous, it is interesting. Maybe Apple's engineers are just doing donuts in the parking lot at night. because they're so happy that they're on they're on the Apple Car team. They gotta blow off some steam, right?
Hey, anything's possible, right?
Yeah. So kind of related to that story is on the other side of town, I guess.
Just a few blocks away, actually.
Okay, right. So Apple's working on the supposedly working on high-end car systems. So what kind of systems are they looking at in this facility?
This is a pretty interesting story because just kind of poking around this week and seeing what I could find, going through, you know, documents related to improvements and permits and stuff in the area, I also came across another building that Apple is leasing where they also put in improvements for a quote-unquote auto testing center, which is a couple blocks away down the road from where the noise complaint was. And what was really interesting about this was back in June of 2014, the city manager of Sunnyvale, where the property is located, actually was boasting about it on their website in a biweekly blog that she does detailing new projects coming to the area. And the city manager posted on there saying that Apple's building, where they're located, quote, will be used as a testing facility for new electronic technologies that are integrated into high-end cars. So you could read that a lot of ways, obviously. At its most basic level, Apple obviously has a platform called CarPlay, which is integrated in a number of cars, which is just a basic infotainment system for directions and music and that sort of stuff. But obviously, new electronic technologies in high-end cars and a testing facility paired with the permit for a quote-unquote auto testing center is only going to fuel more speculation that this is another building where Project Titan work may be underway.
Interesting. The CarPlay platform is, Ferrari and who else is that? I guess that's the highest end consumer manufacturer that integrates CarPlay into their OEM system, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, this makes me think of I know I'm going to give some people seizures when I say this, but you know, the Moto Rocker and how that was kind of Apple dipping its toes into the phone business before the iPhone came out. Obviously, the Moto Rocker was disaster and a joke, but I look at this and wonder if, you know, there's talk about CarPlay, talk about Project Titan, talk about whatever. What if they're all related? What if the CarPlay team, at its most basic level, yeah, sure, they're working on, you know, improving that system, but what if they're using that as a basis point or a launching pad to dip their toes into the automotive market and seeing what they can do, whether they're going to make the brains for future self-driving cars manufactured by anybody, or whether they're going to make their own car or what have you. I mean, you have to think that that's a starting point for them, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is getting into the car itself. I mean, in any way, is a big first step, right?
Right.
Manufacturers are traditionally very closed off and restrictive of what you put in the car, especially when it comes to software, something that they can lose control of very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, it is feasible that the CarPlay team is working on something like that. I feel like the automotive sector is not high margin enough for Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with iPhone, right, continuing on with your, or extending your analogy to the Moto Rocker, they then created the iPhone, which is, you know, it's a piece of hardware that was cut whole cloth, right? They manufactured it themselves. If they did the same with a car, they wouldn't see those high margins, right? Because, I mean, there's already, it's not like they're breaking new ground unless they make the iPhone of cars, although I don't know what that could be. I mean, the car industry has such a long history I'm not sure that there's anything really you can do as far as a innovation that is going to catch on with the general public, right?
Well, you could say the same thing about the watch business.
It's a little bit different, though, because from comparing a few $100 device to something that some people, you know, take out a second mortgage to pay for, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think when you're entering in that high stratum of toys, I guess, it's kind of a different story. I feel like you can make these great changes with high volume products like iPhone, right? You can drive down memory prices. You can corner the market on storage and stuff like that. But with a car, you have a whole slew of manufacturers that have been doing this stuff for over 100 years in some cases, right? To come in and create something new is incredibly difficult. It's at its most basic level, the car has been for a very, very long time, four wheels, an engine, and a steering wheel, right? It's hard to reinvent the wheel, I guess, in that way.
But is it not a market ripe for change? I mean, everybody knows that self-driving cars are inevitable. I mean, that's just the reality of it, right? We all know that it's coming. It's just a question of how quickly. And then there's, you know, all the concern about fossil fuels and reliance on oil and gas and that sort of stuff that just factors into a sense of urgency that a company like Apple could potentially bring to the table.
Right.
I think, you know, you can't reinvent the car that much, but it's still an industry that is ripe for change. It's just a matter of the technology catching up.
It'd be interesting to see if Apple does get into this, how successful they could be, because we already have companies like GM, huge corporations that are that have backgrounds in these electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they brought them to market or not, you know, it's neither here nor there. They've done the research previously, and you know they can build on that. The first electric cars were, I don't know, more than 50 years ago, right? I don't know when the first one was.
Even go back to, you know, trolleys and things like that.
Right. So there...
Monorails.
Apple does have... Right. Apple does have something to bring, but I feel like they need something more than just an electric car if they're going to do it themselves, you know? Like, if we're going to see an Apple car sitting in an Apple store, you know, with a window sticker of, I don't know, 70 grand or however much they're going to price it at.
Well, you won't see that because the auto lobby won't allow it. The dealers, which is the issue that Tesla has been running into.
Yeah. It's easier for them in places like Hawaii, though.
Yeah. I have an in-law that owns a Tesla, and he loves it. And he, a few years ago, drove down from North Carolina to Miami in it. He did the math and figured that there were enough charging stations that he could stop at to make it economical and not a royal pain to get down there, and it worked out pretty well.
How is Musk doing with rolling out the superchargers or whatever they call those hubs?
Are those the battery swap stations or?
I think
or just the quick chargers.
I think it's just those quick charge stations, but they're strategically located across highly trafficked areas.
Yeah, I mean, I know you can get from at least North Carolina down to Florida. I don't know if you can drive across the continental United States with it, but
interesting. Plus, a lot of malls are putting in chargers, and you can maybe make that trip for free.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the breaking point for this kind of stuff is, your average person that owns a car probably takes a road trip at least once a year, right? So if I've got an electric car and, you know, I got a family and, you know, three kids and we're driving to see the family in Michigan or something up from Florida, If you're driving a gas car, you can refuel that in 2 minutes. If you're driving an electric car and it takes, you know, 4 hours to recharge your car to get another 250 miles range out of it, that kills your trip. I mean, you can't be stopping every 4 hours for, you know, a 4 hour charge or even a 2 hour charge. You got to get that charge down to like, if you can get it down to like 30 minutes, you know, and get, you know, 250, 300 miles out of it, and you stop for lunch or something like that, stretch your legs. I think then you're at a point where for the average person, it could replace their daily car. But there's always this talk of the average person only drives X number of miles a day. Well, yeah, the average person does only drive X number of miles a day, but the average person also goes on road trips and drives the family down to Disney World or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, all this stuff is going to get better as battery technology increases, but...
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. It'll take a while, and that...
But is Apple the company to fix that?
Judging by their iPhone battery life and Apple Watch battery life, they're not.
Right.
But, I mean, but who knows?
So I'm looking at it now, because I don't follow Tesla as closely as I suppose I should, but... the first generation Tesla supercharger stations, which are out there now, can fast charge in less than an hour. Mm. Now, there are 2,000 superchargers in 400 stations worldwide. In October 2014, there were 119 standard Tesla supercharger stations operating in the United States.
Nice.
Now, I guess the battery swap station thing was kind of scrap. They can do it for maintenance or something, but...
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, the battery swapping thing was genius because it solved your problem. You just roll the car over it, new battery, good to go, bam, get out of there.
Yeah, it's also very high friction, though. I mean, you're going to, so many things could go wrong with that. Plus, you have to maintain that.
The first thing it made me think of was somebody gets like a bootleg battery in their Tesla
and right.
pulls up to the supercharger station and then swaps it out for a good one, you know?
Right.
I mean, you'd have to have like some sort of fingerprinting thing for the battery to make sure it was a legitimate one, because you know some Chinese company is going to make a knockoff or something.
Right. The way I see it, I think the first step, of course, is they're going to have to maybe not launch a full-blown car, mm-hmm. right? Maybe a partnership or loan their technology out. Or, I don't know, they could license it. Who knows?
Do they really want to become the Microsoft Windows of cars, though?
I don't know. It would be different, though, I suppose. Windows, I mean, obviously the end game there was to get on every single PC out there, right? I mean, that was their end game. Apple can be more selective about who they partner with.
Right.
They have ties with BMW. They have ties with Ferrari, with Q, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they could potentially roll out like a small pilot program to these high-end makers where there's a bit more leeway as far as vehicle customization goes, see how it works out there, and then maybe step into manufacturing. Because... I don't know. From the beginning, this whole idea that Apple can just build a car at volume sounded ridiculous to me.
Yeah, but I think that the problem with that logic of just partnering with Ferrari or whatever is that's not Apple's business model. This company right. is in the business of selling millions of devices.
Right.
That I mean, that is when they enter a market, they want to sell a ton of them. You know, they want to sell 10 million Apple Watches a quarter. The Apple TV did well for years, and they still considered it a hobby because it wasn't moving the needle for them. And obviously, you know, they have some niche products like, you know, iPods still sell in the millions, but they have different models of them and Macs. You have different varieties of them and stuff like that. But, you know, I think that for Apple to enter into that market and just sell, you know, $100,000 and up cars or something crazy like that, and partner in that market doesn't seem like something the Apple of 2016 would do.
Right. Well, what if we think about it this way? What if we think about the car as an iPhone accessory?
Mm-hmm.
Right? If they could somehow manage that.
So you think, you know, the iPhone, Apple's bread and butter in terms of making money, is that Apple's business strategy going forward is just to sell things that are so dependent on your iPhone that you get more hooked in the ecosystem and the iPhone becomes the center of your digital life?
Well, I mean, it's been kind of the undercurrent of their business has been going that way for a few years now, right? I mean, iPhone is obviously their biggest driver. It's the thing that everyone looks at as far as sales goes.
Right.
Even their newest device that launched is basically useless without an iPhone. So everything is pointing to iPhone now, but I mean, we have to imagine that someday they're going to have to move away from that, right?
Yeah, I would expect that the Apple Watch, hopefully sooner rather than later, becomes less dependent on the iPhone. I would hope that it turns into, integrated LTE radio, and obviously things like continuity for jumping between devices would be nice, and that's not going to go anywhere. But to have an Apple Watch that, like, to be able to just go out for the day and not bring my phone and just bring my watch would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you think that the next gen Apple Watch is going to have a cellular capability and be more of a standalone device?
You know, I've heard that, and we even got kind of word of that from somebody that we know. We did not report on it on the website because I just don't feel like they're there yet. The first gen model is, the battery life's actually not bad. I've never ever had my Apple Watch go into low power mode, but I'm also kind of paranoid about low power modes. So, like, I will, if I'm getting ready to go out, take my watch off, put it on the charger for a half hour, and get a juice back up. Same thing with my phone, just because, especially living in New York, it's like with buildings and stuff, your signal just gets killed immediately. Like, the first thing I do if I'm going to be leaving the house for more than a couple hours is put my phone in low power mode, just because I know that it's going to die if I don't do that. And I bring a Mophie with me and all that.
It's kind of obsessive, Neil.
A little bit. I'm a little OCD. So I don't think, while I think the battery life on the Apple Watch is not that bad, I don't think that they're there yet. I don't think the technology is there yet to make your watch have its own LTE radio. And I don't think, we've discussed this before, I don't think that you're going to see GPS in the Apple Watch until they have an LTE radio in there, because GPS alone takes forever to get a signal lock. So I think that you're only going to see GPS when LTE is in there. Maybe next year, but my gut says not this year.
Right. I mean, and the way Apple does it on maps, for Apple Maps, I mean, it's streaming data down, right? I mean, it's not like, what was that? GPS. One of the first third-party GPS programs allowed you to download a map of your area, right? So you could use it offline.
Yeah, Google Maps does that. Yeah, you can download an area. Yeah.
So, I mean, it. Other than the watch not having perhaps that kind of capacity, storage capacity, it would have to have some sort of cellular radio to bring in that data.
And well, not necessarily. I mean, you can, if you were going for a run, for example, there are plenty of devices out there that have, because that would be, I think, the number one use for GPS on the watch would be for exercise. You're going for a bike ride, you're going for a run, you want to track your speed. There are plenty of devices out there that don't have the data accessible, but can then, when you get back home and get on Wi-Fi, take the GPS coordinates and apply them to a map. So it actually does that. I had a first-generation Microsoft Band that I tested, and it would take sometimes 15 minutes to get a GPS lock. But when I got home and got back on Wi-Fi and reconnected my phone and all that, it would take my run and then put it on a map in Runkeeper and then upload it to Runkeeper. So it worked. I actually got a faster GPS signal with the Fitbit Surge, I believe it was called. But I wonder if there was some trickery going on there too, where it kind of guesstimates your speed based on the pedometer as it tries to narrow down GPS.
It depends whether how many satellites they're locking onto, right?
Right.
I mean, some have a lower tolerance for accuracy.
And your iPhone and things like that will use known Wi-Fi networks and cellular towers and all kinds of other little trickery to make it look like you're getting a GPS signal. Yeah. But getting the actual GPS lock for multiple satellites takes like up to 5 minutes.
Yeah. So assisted GPS is a thing that exists.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, to your point, I feel like Apple wouldn't release a watch with GPS that just logs coordinates, mm-hmm. and later you can upload something, because I feel like consumers will be like, oh, hey, this is GPS, but what? Why can't I see the map? Where's
right?
It had GPS. I mean, what's going on here? To avoid that confusion, I guess I'd say. And also, there's the power concerns, right? I mean, the ever-present battery anxiety issues.
Right.
They've done such an incredible job scaling down all of that circuitry and silicon architecture. And even the battery itself, right, is fairly dense for a small unit. But still, it's powering these components that are just sucking it dry. So there's going to have to be a change there.
We had an exclusive story this week where Apple put out a job listing advertising they want people to work on new watch faces for the Apple Watch. Now, I realize that's not exactly a shocking piece of news that Apple would be interested in creating new watch faces. You know, that's an obvious direction for at least this year with the watch and potentially a Watch OS 3 coming this fall, or maybe sooner, depending on how quickly Watch OS 2 came out. You got to think about where you want to see the platform expand and what you want to see it do, not just in terms of the hardware, but also in terms of the software. Because I feel like the watch does so much so well that I feel compelled to wear it every day, which is a good thing. But there are so many little areas where it falls short, where you can see the potential, you can see where it's going. But it's like, why aren't we there yet? Why is that taking so long? You know, this should have been addressed in Watch OS 2. I think that I really want to see more, obviously, better third-party apps, better third-party app integration. Like if you try to run with a third-party app, the watch will automatically return to the watch face. It only stays on the activity app if you're using Apple's activities app, you know? Right. And then, like, right. There's like little things like that where Apple needs to sort out a way to let, and they haven't even really fixed this on the iPhone in a lot of ways. Like you think about how Apple Maps has this gorgeous display where it kind of takes over the lock screen and shows you where you're going as you're using it. But like Google Maps and stuff are kind of forced to do push notifications on the screen and kind of work around it because they're not, you know, they're not Apple and they don't get to break the rules the way Apple does with their own apps. And it would be nice to see a way to allow third-party developers to do stuff like that without abusing it by using the review process. And maybe something that uses certain APIs gets more scrutiny as to how they use it. But for a third-party running app like RunKeeper, it should just show me RunKeeper when I raise my wrist and I'm using it. The watch knows I'm running. I realize that there's a setting to make it show you the last thing you're doing, but I don't want to have to turn that on and off every time.
Yeah, contextual app management is always difficult.
Yeah, it's very
because
difficult.
After all, it is a for however intelligent it is still just a dumb machine.
Right.
Right.
But, Apple has a review process in place where they could potentially say, you want access to this API, it's going to take a month for us to review your app because there's going to be a backlog and we got to get through them. But here's what you can do and how you can do it. I feel like there's got to be a responsible way to give apps more control over how the device is used, especially with the watch, because the less I interact with my watch, the better. I mean, how often do you honestly hit the digital crown button and go to the home screen on your watch and open a third-party app? How often do you do that?
I rarely do that.
And then what about the glances when you swipe up and you have all these things down there?
Yeah, I do that more often.
I do that more often, but how often do you, like, once you get more than, like, three of them on there, it's kind of useless, right?
Yeah, I mean, you got to swipe through them. I usually keep the most used apps, like, towards the front.
So my number one is the quick settings, so airplane mode, do not disturb, silent, that kind of stuff. My second one is music and the music controls. My third one is my activities for the day, and you know, my circles and stuff like that. Then I have battery, heart rate, maps, weather, and then I have the ESPN one. It's the only third-party one I have installed on there. But I never scroll over that far. It's just, I'd rather just pull my phone out at that point. It's going to take me too long.
Yeah, it's... They gotta do something. But I feel like, you know, this first generation, they're keeping pretty tight control over it.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Right.
They don't...
No third-party watch faces.
Yeah.
I'm just highly disappointed by the third-party complications. I had high hopes for it, but the developers haven't really embraced it, and... The amount of space that you're given to work with on most of the watch faces, unless you go with the modern watch face, it's just not enough to convey the information. It almost feels like they need to kind of just shrink the watch faces a little bit to allow people to get more information on there. Like, why can't I have a complication that combines the weather and the date into one? Because that's just very simple information. Or how about a weather complication that isn't just displaying the temperature, but also has like a little cloud on there, or sun or rain or whatever. I feel like there would be visually simple ways to convey more information on that small of a space.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed that no one really has taken the time to make a sweet complication.
And it seems like most of the most interesting ones are using the modern face, because you can have lines of text on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the calendar complication is completely worthless if you're not on the modern watch face.
Yeah. I don't know. There has to be some sort of a common glyph interface that we can glance at. Well, that needs to be made, though, because for a screen that small, we can't rely on their San Francisco text.
Right. Right.
It's just too small. There needs to be some sort of symbology going on. But speaking of updates, is it six segue I did?
Oh, yeah.
App updates. Apple TV recently got an interesting new feature in the TV OS 9.2 beta, the third beta, that is. A much requested and much needed feature, as far as I'm concerned. And what was that, Neil?
So... In the third beta of tvOS 9.2, Apple has added a voice dictation feature. So when you come up to a text entry field, rather than having to scroll back and forth with your Siri remote or break out your iPhone to use the Apple remote app, you can hold the Siri button and just speak what you want to search for, and it works much like you'd expect. Just say the words, and then you're off. They also added the ability to use a Siri command anywhere to search the App Store. So you can hold it and say, search the App Store for Netflix. It will automatically whisk you away to the App Store searching for Netflix. So Apple is kind of heard the text entry woes that people experienced with the new Apple TV when it launched last fall. And they've been quickly addressing it with software updates, which is a welcome change for Apple, who historically has held on to big features like that for major updates rather than 0.1 updates. A great example is the fact that you still cannot clear all notifications at once on your iPhone when you swipe down from Notification Center. Yet I can do it with Force Touch on my Apple Watch. So why there isn't a 3D Touch option to clear all notifications in iOS 9 on my iPhone 6S, I don't know. But that's Apple for you.
They will tell you when you can do that, all right?
You know, and it's such not a small before. Feature, like, roll it into 9.3 for the iPhone. You know, just be like, oh, now you can do that. Be like, oh, okay, great. But it feels like there's a lot of, like, stockpiling of features to go, oh, iOS 10, here it is.
Well, I mean, they have to have at least five new features to change that, to have that ticker roll over.
Does it matter, right? Really, when you're not charging for the software update, that we have these like big 0.0 updates all the time? Especially now Apple's locked themselves into this annual release cycle. If they decided to make a 9.5 this year instead of an iOS 10, people would be angry, and it would just be a number. It could be the exact same update, and they could call it 9.5, and people would say, oh, Apple's doomed. So what would you expect to see in an iOS 10? Since, you know, we've got these betas out, I'm running 9.3 on my phone and my iPad, unfortunately. The battery life's terrible on it, so don't install it if you're not, if it's your primary phone. The Apple Pencil is still broken in beta 3, where you can't tap on icons on the home screen, and probably going to ship that way. But we had a few pictures today. A reader sent us one of in New Jersey, one of the Apple Maps vans driving around at night, and there was another one in Boston driving around like 9:30 at night. Obviously not gathering a lot of street view pictures and stuff at night. But it was kind of interesting. I thought that these maps were out there. The mapping vans were out there, and you got to think that that's going to be some sort of thing they flip the switch on for iOS 10, right? I mean, they've been working on this for a while.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have the maps thing, which, you know, whatever their version of Street View. I imagine it's going to be something like you enter flyover, but you can zoom in and it's going to just swoop you into Street View.
Mm-hmm.
Or like some sort of a high resolution ground level mapping that's seamless, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something like that. And also, they've been paying a lot more attention to their first party apps, like Notes. With the recent iPad Pro launch, they revamped it for Pencil.
Right.
So I mean, just those things. I don't think they're gonna harp on the small, unfortunately for you, things like Clear All messages.
It's so simple. It's already on the watch. Come on. And there's usually some big iOS update feature that we don't know about until the next iPhone is announced. So for those who don't know the schedule, Apple is very predictable on this kind of stuff. June, Worldwide Developers Conference, announce a new iOS and a new macOS. But there's a key feature to the new iOS that remains hidden until the new iPhone comes out because it relies on a hardware component. So obviously last year's iPhone 6S key feature was the 3D touch capabilities within iOS. And then to a lesser extent, you had things like selfie flash and live photos and that sort of stuff. What do you think they could do hardware-wise to really, make it something worthwhile for an upgrade for people this year, other than just a new look?
Get rid of the headphone jack?
That's going to make them want to upgrade?
Oh, yeah. Tons of people are going to want to do that because they want to buy new hardware.
That is the number one thing that people ask me. When they ask me about a new iPhone coming out, because they know what I do, they say, when's it coming out? Are they really getting rid of the headphone jack? Those are the two things that people are talking about. It's what everybody wants to know. I still don't think they're going to do it. I still remain convinced that Apple will do some sort of a segue where they introduce Lightning headphones and flood the market with Lightning headphones and Bluetooth options and that sort of stuff, and then a year or two later ditch the headphone jack. But I don't think they're just going to go cold turkey. I think that they need to have somewhat of a transition.
Interesting. Well, I mean, how about Lightning? Right? I mean, that was kind of a not quite an identical move, but a move in a similar direction, right? People had hundreds or maybe even thousands of dollars invested in 30-pin docks and all that good stuff.
Yeah, the one thing that they screwed up with the Lightning transition, I think, is the fact that Lightning doesn't properly do video. And so there were a lot of people and a lot of gyms own fancy treadmills with 30-pin connectors to this day. And it used to be that you could take your iPod in there or your iPhone and have video on it and then play it on the screen on the treadmill. And so all these gyms were pissed off that they had these treadmills that were no longer useful. In fact, for a while, my wife was bringing an old iPod Nano and loading video onto that just so she could play stuff on the big screen on the TV there with the 30-pin. So I think that was the one thing that they really screwed up with the Lightning transition. But other than that, I think the benefits were so good in terms of it being reversible and smaller, and there were adapters available for audio devices and stuff like that. I don't think that people cared that much after about 6 months. Then it kind of died down. The problem with getting rid of the headphone jack is you're dealing with a way, way, way bigger ecosystem of devices that depend on a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. Everybody's got headphones that plug into that, and everybody has probably multiple headphones that they use for different purposes. I own many different types of headphones. So I cannot see them just cold turkey cutting it. I don't think it's like Lightning. I don't think it's the same. Because what would your upsell be, right? It would be, you get better sounding audio. Okay.
And better integration of new cool features, because you can transfer data back and forth.
Okay. What are you going to transfer your headphones? I mean, I can already do that with Bluetooth headphones.
DAC. You can have an offboard DAC.
I mean, but think about the person who complains about the missing headphone jack. Think about the, 40-something-year-old guy who is just trying to plug his crap in and go to the gym and work out with his earbuds, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple ways they could do this, right? They could get rid of the jack, include a bundle, an adapter.
They will not include an adapter. They will not do it.
Who knows? They might be forced to. What if
they didn't with USB-C? They didn't with Lightning from 30 pin. They're not going to do it. There's no way.
What if there's such a outcry from the public that they are forced to send out some sort of adapter?
Right. That is what I'm talking about. And that is the PR disaster that I don't think Apple wants to deal with. Listen, the headphone jack has to die. It has to. It's inevitable. But I mean, you can't get rid of it on an iPhone and then still have it on a Mac. Then you have to have a Lightning port on a Mac, too.
Right. Well, unless they go Bluetooth.
They're not even going to have any sort of input on a Mac for audio?
Who knows? I mean, no, well, of course you could. Well, Mac is different. I mean, they can keep these legacy ports, right? Legacy formats. So
I don't think they would. Space. I don't think they would.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get rid of it this cycle. Maybe next year, I don't even think next year, maybe a couple years. The next iPhone, what is it, 7, 8, right? The next big redesign, maybe.
I think they get rid of it when they get rid of all the ports. I think that they go whole hog, and because they're doubling down on Lightning right now. You take away the headphone jack just to make it thinner, but then you still have another port on there, which, it while thinner, isn't that much thinner. It's still a port.
Right.
Well, we talked about last week about a smart connector on the iPad Pro and how maybe that's kind of the Lightning replacement of the future once they get it up to spec and stuff like that. What if that became your charging replacement and connecting to accessories?
Right. Well, I mean, the way smart connector works is very similar to the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, right? I mean, it has the basic electrical contacts on the inside, and it interfaces with that. Yeah, but I mean, getting rid of all the ports is definitely something that I would want. You can super weatherproof your phone, and it would finally take on the iPhone's true form as a black monolith. That is devoid of any design cues. It's just a slate of glass.
Yeah, I mean, you got to look at it and think there are certain things that are coming eventually, whether 2 years or 10 years. No more home button. Integrate 3D touch integrate Touch ID into the screen itself. Some form of wireless charging. Those kind of things. They just seem like they have to happen. Getting rid of the Lightning jack, getting rid of the headphone jack, but I don't really see any of that coming this year. It just seems too soon. It seems like too much, and it would be a complete public relations disaster for Apple to release a iPhone without a headphone jack, without an adapter, and without a adequate number of Lightning headphones on the market. Because I mean, it would be easy for me, right? Like, I'm wearing my Master Dynamic headphones right now. They're $400 headphones. And they have a removable cable at both ends. So theoretically, they could sell me a headphone wire that would be 3.5 millimeter on one end to plug into the headphones itself, and then Lightning on the other, right?
It depends. I mean, those high-end headphones need to be driven, right? I don't know about Master Dynamic, but sometimes the...
Yeah. I'm not going to go buy a new $400 set of headphones to work to use with my new iPhone. And I'm going to get some, you know, crappy dongle for $35 that Apple's going to sell. I mean,
Beats is going to sell it, and it's going to be great.
I think that's what you do. You sell new EarPods, or you put in the box new EarPods that are Lightning, but you keep the headphone jack on there. But you make the cost of making Lightning headphones basically nothing. Make the licensing fees so small that every pair of headphones comes in a stupid ancient headphone jack that's on your Android phone or sweet new Lightning connector. And so by the time you ditch the headphone jack, everybody's already got a pair of Lightning headphones anyhow, or Bluetooth. Right.
And it also increases ecosystem stickiness, right?
Exactly.
When you basically are forcing third-party manufacturers to use your format that is only on your phone.
Right.
Yeah, which is kind of what Apple does. They can do it. They have the market share.
And then when they ditch Lightning, it's going to be the same nightmare all over again. Where do I plug in my headphones now? It's all wireless charging and stuff.
Yeah. Hopefully wireless charging actually makes it to the next iPhone. I don't know though. I'm doubtful. I'm dubious.
I don't think so. There was a report a couple weeks ago, was it Bloomberg, said that they were working on wireless charging, but not the contact mat type of wireless charging that everything does now, including the Apple Watch, but actually a long range. And I've seen stuff about this technology before, and it's interesting because one of the ways that you have to look at it is it's not necessarily about charging your phone as it is as much reducing the drain on it. So imagine that you had a bunch of Apple devices in your home that when they were within range of some sort of puck that was sending out, you know, electricity through the air, that while it might give you cancer, trickle charges your iPhone to a point where maybe it doesn't recharge it, but it slows the drain on it.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I mean, I'm not a fan of having radio waves passing through my body every single day, and especially being in very close proximity to such a device.
Right.
But it would be really great for my iPhone battery.
That's true. And you could have them, I mean, you could set them up wherever, like in the way that we set up Wi-Fi hotspots now throughout a city.
Mm-hmm. I think the range is 5 meters or something, or is it 15 meters? It's either 5 or 15 meters. I'm not sure. Is the current limit.
Is it powerful enough to recharge though, or is it just?
No. Well, it depends because it's it diminishes as you leave the proximity of the central hub.
But you could do it like household wide where it would reduce battery drain, right? Essentially?
Yeah.
The net effect would be you're still losing power, but it's trickle charging it back.
Right. Yeah, it would be kind of like the concepts from the 50s of the atomic house.
Yeah.
Your house is the power station.
Yeah.
And everything just connects into that grid. But you're also in that grid. You're a piece of meat.
Getting cooked.
Living in this oven of what you're saying. Just to keep the percentage like a status quo, right? Mm-hmm. Just keep it at a certain level. And then when you leave the house, that's the only time basically that you'll be draining the battery. And who knows? I mean, places like Starbucks could integrate these hubs at relatively low cost. And then the only time you'd actually be draining the battery is when you're away from building infrastructure.
And whether it's recharging or it's the battery itself, you know, this is the main breakthrough that technology has been sorely needing for the last forever, right? I mean, you look at everything else.
Since the Walkman.
You look at the processing speed. You look at the screen quality. You look at the capabilities of what you can do now. I mean, I can edit a full-length movie on my iPhone, and it looks pretty dang good. And, you know, just the power is so incredible. And yet the battery technology... it just has not kept up with the pace of everything else.
Yeah. And I mean, the software developers have done a really great job as well, right? Cutting down on code and Apple's helped a lot with their ARM architecture to streamline basically everything.
Everything's shrunk to the device. Now, if you break it open, it's just a big battery in there with a bunch of small parts.
Yeah. Batteries are hard. That system in itself would take up a bunch of space in the phone. And I just don't think that, well, the 7 is supposedly a bit thinner, right, than the 6S. So I don't see how they can cram yet another very major module in there.
Well, that's kind of the most interesting thing to me about the iPhone 7 is we don't really have any concrete rumors on what it's going to do, what it's going to be. You think 2 years ago, we knew that Apple was going to do two bigger iPhones. We knew the screen size. We knew it months ahead of time. We knew it like a year ahead of time. You think back to last year, we knew that the 6S was going to do 3D touch on the phone. We knew about the Touch ID fingerprint sensor back with the iPhone 5S. We knew about the taller form factor with the iPhone 5. I don't know that we knew Siri as well with the 4S, going back to that. But other than that, I mean, the last 4 or 5 years, we've really had a good idea every year what the iPhone's going to be and what it's going to do. And the only thing everybody's talking about this year is ditching the headphone jack. I mean, is that going to be its defining feature?
Well, the dual cameras.
Oh, yeah, but apparently only on the 7 Plus or something is the rumor, so...
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if that bodes well for Apple. I mean, what if they're... Assumedly, they haven't turned off the leaks in China.
Right.
Apparently, those are still going. So if there's nothing to leak at this stage, either they're still prototyping and are scrambling to get everything done in time, which would be bad, right? I mean, they're going to have another supply-constrained launch like last year.
I wonder if they're cramping down pretty well because... We don't even have solid leaks on the 4-inch iPhone.
Mm,
that's true. There was like a weird Photoshop of someone just made it look like a smaller iPhone 6, but we don't really have. And usually, by this point, we start getting parts, and it might just be something as stupid as a flex cable or something like that. But we haven't had any of those this year, and I wonder if Tim Cook and company have kind of done something on their end to cut down on the riffraff out of China.
Well, it depends, right? I mean, if the 4-inch iPhone is probably not going to be a high-volume product, right? So it depends what manufacturer they're using.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like most of the leaks come out of Foxconn.
Yeah, because the factories are so big.
If they're going with a smaller assembly or a manufacturing and assembly chain, then it could be feasible that nothing is going to leak.
But even guys like Ming-Chi Kuo haven't really chimed in with some sort of hot take on what the iPhone 7 is going to do and what's going to make it stand out. There's just this like expectation, especially from Wall Street and all that. It's like, okay, iPhone sales are going to dip next quarter, but the 7 is going to change it all and they're going to return to growth. And maybe it will. That would be great for Apple, but what are they going to do? What is going to stimulate that growth? How are they? I mean, is a dual camera system that takes that can zoom for photos? Is that really going to be that big of a selling point?
I don't know. There's not really much more you can do with a smartphone without introducing completely new technology, right? What else can they add on there that adds value? It's already a great point and shoot camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's a communication device. It basically killed the portable GPS market.
Mm-hmm.
It's a music player.
Yeah.
What else? What else can it do? Turn into a car?
The brains of your car.
Could be.
Yeah.
It's going to be thinner.
You know, I think with Apple Pay and Touch ID and 3D Touch, Apple's clearly been leading the way in innovation in the smartphone race when you compare it to, you know, the other leader, Samsung, and like, what's their big innovation of the last 3 years?
The bendy screen.
Yeah, a screen
you
that
can see it.
A screen that curves around the side, and it's like, I really don't care about that. So I got to give Apple a lot of credit for continuing to innovate in a market where you look at it and say, oof, man, what else can you do here? Like, how much better can you make it? Because the things that we're talking about coming down the pike, like wireless charging or integrating Touch ID into the screen, just the technology is not there yet. We just don't have it yet. So you can make the camera better. You can do those sorts of things, but you can redesign it and make it look new and spiffy, but it's difficult. I think they have their work cut out for them this year because there's a lot of high expectations for the 7 to be like the savior of the iPhone. Not that it's going anywhere, obviously, but just in terms of sales growth. And
it's still growing, but it's not growing as fast. So
well, they already said it's not going to grow next quarter. So
yeah, well, but next quarter, yes, but
right
for the 7. But I mean, so for the 7 and potentially, you know, the 8, they're going to have to stall right until this technology matures. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have to bank on people wanting a new, different looking phone. So perhaps the 7 and the 8 will be greater design departures from their predecessor.
Something to really shake it up.
Yeah, kind of like the shift from the 3G to the 4. Right, that was a pretty big shift. The glass sandwich design.
I love that design.
Yeah, that was a sweet design. Well, unless you count the horrible antenna antenna gap, but they fixed that. So, yeah. So these upcoming iPhones might see a bigger shift in design and aesthetics than previously, because Apple's going to have to bank on that more than what's on the inside.
It's a simple and stupid thing, but I would love to see a range of fun colors for the iPhone beyond what you have now. And I really like, I think the blue iPod Touch metal back looks pretty sharp. I was a big fan of, I didn't buy one, but I liked the look of the iPhone 5C. I liked the way it felt in the hand. I thought it was a pretty good phone. And if they could have the same premium metal feel of a top-tier iPhone with some colors on there, I don't think it would cheapen the product in any way, and I think it would be a stimulant for sales. You know, they're already expanding into gold and the pink rose gold color. So why not go down that road further? Why not give us more?
They do need to differentiate, right? I mean, before it was you had an iPhone. People knew you had an iPhone because it looked different, right?
Yeah.
It came in black.
Yeah.
Then it came in black and white. And then, you know, it started catching on. And now, you know, a whole bunch of people have it. And they only have it in one of a few colors. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe they could go down that road. I mean, the same thing did happen with iPod, so... I guess that would also stimulate growth, right? I mean, people want to be unique.
Yeah.
They want to be their own whatever, their own
person. Yeah, and the combination of the cases that Apple made, I mean, the polka dot cases were kind of cheesy looking or whatever, yeah. But again, it was that customization factor. You get one color for the case, one color for the phone itself. I thought it looked pretty sharp, and I would love to see an iPod Touch element come over with that anodized kind of aluminum look for coloring the iPhone. And I think the last rumor, the consistent rumor about future iPhones that we haven't really touched on is bringing an OLED display, or OLED as some people say, from the Apple Watch to the iPhone. And the only thing I have to say to that is, yes, they may eventually do it if it leads to, you know, thinner design, cost cutting, whatever. But you will not see the power savings with it that you do in the Apple Watch, unless Apple completely redesigned iOS to have a dark user interface. Because for those of you who don't know, an LCD screen has to light up all the pixels no matter what. It has a backlight there. They're all illuminated even when the screen is black. An OLED screen, each individual pixel is lit. So if it's black on the screen, then no power is being used, or very little at least, to send a picture there. So therefore, when you use an Apple Watch and you notice it's a black background, the watch faces are dark, the whole user interface is a dark black background, that is actually a conscious decision by Apple to save battery life on the device and eke out every little bit of power they can out of it. There's not a lot of incentive to do that on an iPhone because an iPhone is colorful and bright and has white backgrounds.
So the last thing we're going to talk about today is, Neil, you did a comparison slash review for the iPad Pro as far as keyboards are concerned. Mm-hmm. You compared Apple's official smart keyboard versus a Logitech Create version, kind of cradle-looking thing.
Yeah.
So what did you find?
I kind of expected to hate both of them. Just because the Apple One is just too thin, doesn't have the row of media keys, and I had messed around with a Microsoft Surface before, and you just couldn't use the thing on your lap. It just didn't work. I came away actually surprised by Apple's One. You can actually use it on your lap. The base on it is sturdy enough. It's not like a laptop where you're going to get multiple viewing angles and stuff like that, but it's actually sturdy enough to hold up the iPad Pro between the magnetic connection and all that. So I came away pretty impressed with that. It does have its shortcomings. If you care about a backlight, you're not going to get one there. And if you want that row of media keys, you're not going to get that there either. So it does have a few sacrifices. The Logitech One, so Apple's One is 180, I think. And then Logitech's One is 150. Maybe 170 for the Apple One, I think, and 150 for the Logitech One. Right. So it's a little bit cheaper. The Logitech One is more of a laptop replacement kind of thing. It protects the back of the iPad, so you have to actually snap the iPad into a plastic case, and then it just makes it heavy. But by being bigger, it actually allows more features. Like, it has the full row of media keys, it's backlit keyboard. Both of them work well. The magnetic connection works fine. The Logitech One did have some lag and keys dropping out that were fixed by the iOS 3 beta and a firmware update. So buyer beware, you may want to wait till iOS 3 comes out with that firmware update integrated into it, which was a pretty seamless process. Just connect to the iPad to it, and it said, hey, there's a firmware update. Do you want to install? Yes. Pushed it to the keyboard. Done. I think that there's a market for both of these. I prefer the Apple Smart Keyboard. Because the Apple Smart Keyboard is very thin and light and portable, and I don't want to use my iPad with a keyboard all the time. Most of the time, I just have a regular smart cover, and I just snap it off and just use it as a tablet in my hands. And then sometimes if I want to stand it up, I go get my smart cover and connect it, and then if I want to have a keyboard, then I can just snap this one on. Snapping the iPad into and out of the Logitech Create keyboard is a little bit more work. And kind of an effort. Plus, it just makes the thing so bulky and big that despite its handful of shortcomings, I got to give the nod to the Apple One. But as I said, depending on your use case, if you really want it to stay in a folio-style protective case that'll protect the back of your iPad Pro, I think you'll be happy with the Logitech One, though it is a little bulky.
What does the key feel on the Logitech? Because I have the Apple One, and I'm pretty happy with the key feel. I can type fast,
yeah.
And it's good for touch typing.
It really is, considering the small design, right?
Yeah. I was impressed.
The Apple One has a kind of a textured cloth cover over the keys, and it feels nice on your fingertips, and the keys have enough travel and enough sound that it feels good. I would have to give the nod to the Logitech keyboard just in terms of how the keys feel, because they're more traditional plastic keys inside of a thicker plastic base, so they feel more like a laptop keyboard. But I didn't really. I mean, I'm not a picky keyboard person, is what I would say. I know when it's a bad keyboard. I wouldn't consider either of these to be bad keyboards. And typing on both of them, working on my review, I had no problems typing on either of them. It was perfectly fine.
Gave the Apple version a 4 out of 5, uh-huh. And the Logitech a 3.5.
Yep.
Pretty close.
Yep. Yeah, I give the nod to the Apple One just for the portability. And because it doesn't cover the back of the iPad, you can just snap it off and throw it away somewhere and go do your thing with your iPad as a tablet. And, you know, 75 to 90% of the time with my iPad, I'm just using it as a tablet. I'm not interested in replacing my MacBook. If I really need a keyboard that bad, I'll go to my MacBook. But there are times when it's nice to just have a keyboard there with your iPad. So for those occasions, great. For $170, let's get that price down closer to $100, Apple.
You're dreaming. You're dreaming.
Hey, if the pencil can cost $100, then why not a keyboard?
Well, I guess so. The pencil is quite packed with goodies.
Yeah.
That was our show for today. Wrapping up episode 55. Where can they reach you, Neil, on the Twitters?
My handle on Twitter is at this is Neil. And I just recently crossed 500 followers on Twitter.
Ooh.
So.
You're ahead of me.
Well, I don't follow anybody back. So I think that, and I don't tweet that much. But if you do have a question, there are a few listeners that tweet at me on the regular. And I do appreciate the feedback and the commentary.
Awesome. And I'm Mikey Campbell. You can reach me at Mikey Campbell 81.
And you tweet a lot more than I do.
Yeah, but it's nonsensical tweets.
You were commenting on the debate the other night, so.
Well, I do that because it's hilarious. All right. Well, anyway, thanks for listening, and have a good one.